Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help. When I was young, so much younger.
Hello and welcome to Real Recovery. So glad you're here with us tonight. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio and at his home studio facing the lake, a man who lives in a shack off the end of a dirt road and prefers barbed wire over traditional chain link fencing, George P. Fraser. Hello, George.
Yeah, actually, that's pretty close.
It is pretty close. You know, yeah. I don't know why you just don't have a regular chain link fence. I don't know why the barbed wire. I don't question.
Well, you left the landmines out, Bill, but other than that, it was accurate.
Yeah, well, how you doing? Close. I'm good, and I am glad that we've got another award-winning episode of Real Recovery ready to go. And I was reading this week on the number of, I hate to start off with bad news, but there was like 20,000 more overdose from opioids and fentanyl in the last year than the previous year. And I think, well, yeah, people get into the COVID lifestyle. This is something that does not surprise me. Alcohol use goes up, drug use goes up, depression goes up. All kinds of bad things that have people turn to drugs and alcohol.
Well, and the opportunity from my alcoholic's mind standpoint, if I don't have to be to work tomorrow, it's going to be a party time. And I think all those things, I think a big part is the collective community of recovery for staying sober. Thank God that we have the technology to do Zoom.
Yep.
And other things that helped me a lot to connect with people, not only for church, but recovery, in that I think for the first time in my life during COVID, there were moments where I felt alone.
Yeah. I remember you saying that.
And mostly, but it did. With the bad comes the good. I didn't have to make up excuses for graduation parties, funerals, or weddings. Okay. Can I be honest?
Yeah.
And, but I think social distancing has been a lifestyle choice for years for me.
That's true. Nothing's really changed that much with George F.
But, the little interday, reactions and interactions of people, the smile, with the mask on when you went to the store and all that. Yeah, I felt kind of like nobody recognized my humanity, I guess, and I got a little lonely.
Yeah. The good news is we are here in the month of July in 2021, and pretty much the masks have come off, but you never know what's going to happen next. But the important thing is that if you are getting back in with your recovery group, you're getting back with your home group, you're enjoying that fellowship at church again, you're making great strides in restoring your recovery to a much healthier place.
A lot easier to stay sober when you can have contact with people.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill, you know, we always do a step on our show. I know you listen.
I read about that. Yeah, no, I read about it. Yeah, New York Times.
I talk about step one a lot, but I wanted to tonight, where we admitted we're powerless over drugs and alcohol in our lives. Become unmanageable. And I actually want to read a little bit from the Blue Recovery book.
Okay.
Something that I've been working on, and I don't want any laughter from you or Ryan.
Okay.
As I'm reading this, mute your mics. But I'm going to start here. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based on self, which later place us in a position to be hurt. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must get rid of this selfishness. We must or it will kill us. God makes that possible, and there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. This is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are his agents. He is the father, and we are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. There's a lot there, but basically it gets back to Genesis 3, Bill. We want to be God in our own life. We want to have the knowledge that God does. We want to make ourselves in charge of our life. And in the 12-step program that we talk about every week, and we emphasize there's nothing magical in the steps. They're how a lot of us walk out our faith to overcome our troubles. They point to the need of Jesus for me in that I read that and go, hey, that's me. You know, self will run riot. Yeah, I got two speeds. My foot's to the floor or the car's off. Right? Yeah. That's how a lot of us go through life. And God gives us the knowledge, Bill, through the Holy Spirit, that we are that way, that we can't do it ourselves because we really kind of like this, but it's not working. And then he convicts us that this isn't in his will, and he's the one that can help us walk out of it.
And, George, when we talk about being powerless, that doesn't mean you're incompetent, right? Doesn't it just mean that you can't rely on your own willpower to just achieve any kind of peace or wholeness or recovery? If God doesn't help with that, you're never going to achieve anything.
Well, I go back to Scripture, as you always do, Bill, and I look at John 15:5. Jesus said, apart from me, you can do nothing. And I think it's such a great question on your part. I always like to ask my guys and myself, because I don't ask my guys to do anything I'm not doing. George, what do you have control over? What do you have power over? Your next breath comes at the mercy of an all-sovereign God. And the humility of that is, on my own, I can do nothing, but I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, Philippians 4:13. What I've found in this through my addiction is the Bible's true. It's trustworthy. It's true. God is faithful. He's in control. And I think, Bill, anytime we sin, we are playing God in our life because we're going to do what we want rather than what God wants.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's a disease or sinful behavior, I believe addiction is sinful behavior that culminates in a disease.
Yeah.
And so I need to go to the source that can, the only source that can alleviate and remove my sin and forgive me, and that's Jesus.
Yeah. I like that, George. Nicely said. Once again, very eloquent, George F. I appreciate that. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to bring on our guest, Peggy, tonight. She's got her story to tell. We'll be right back in just a minute.
Can get it wrong and still think that it's all right.
All Okay, I mean it when I say it. I'm so glad you're with us tonight on Real Recovery, Bill and George. We've got Ryan on the board. We continue our award-winning program with yet another award-winning episode tonight. George, I'm looking forward to this.
Can't wait to get to it, Bill.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're going to bring Peggy Isaacson onto the show, and she is from the Detroit Lakes, Minnesota area. So this was a road trip for her. So we're very glad to have her with us in studio. Peggy, welcome.
Thank you. It's so great to be here.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
Well, I think she really means that, George.
Hey, that's nice.
Yeah.
Well, we're excited to be here too, Bill.
Yes, we are. That's a fact. So all three of us are excited. Ryan, are you excited?
Good catch.
Oh, Ryan's coming on.
I'm happy to be here. Absolutely.
So I add the question was, are you excited?
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. I am excited.
Okay,
yes.
Good. That's the word I was looking for.
That's his excited voice.
Yeah, it's a good voice. All right. We love stories. And Peggy, your story is incredible, and you are a very gifted writer. So when I read your story, I was, wow, what a page turner.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. And usually beginnings can have toughness, adversity, and some trauma involved. And I think yours is no exception.
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know what else to say to that.
Pick one of those words and run with it.
It's a page turner.
Yeah. Let's hear a little bit about what happened when you were young.
Well, where I started out. I was born in a sheep on a sheep farm up near Fergus Falls, Minnesota. And my mother was an alcoholic, had some very serious mental issues that were not diagnosed at that point in time. For the listeners that don't know it, I am an older person. I'm not in my 20s, or at least I probably don't sound like it. But anyway, so in the early 60s is when I was born, and on a sheep farm by Fergus Falls, Minnesota. And my mother was very, very ill. and my dad, awesome man, had... was trying to run the farm and trying to, same time, take care of myself and my mom. And there was a lot of abuse in the house with my mom, between my mom and me. She would a lot of times forget to feed me. And when she did feed me, she was not, let's say that she was very domestically challenged. The house was always a wreck. And the food that I often got, I remember, were onion sandwiches, white bread with butter and onions sliced up on them. And it took me many, many years before I could eat an onion.
Yeah, well, you're making George hungry, just so you know.
Anyway, so when I was 4 years old, I was standing in the middle of the kitchen doorway, and I had been I had a very, very close relationship with my dad, and I was standing in the kitchen doorway when he came in that evening, waiting for supper, and my mom had been drinking very heavily, and she pulled out a shotgun on him and pointed it at him, and he grabbed the knife off the table that had been used for cutting bread, and they struggled and screamed and struggled, and the shotgun went off and missed my dad, hit the window behind the sink, and littered the blue countertop with cornflakes and glass shards. And that's why the story that I wrote was called Glass Shards and Cornflakes. And that's kind of where it really begins. My mom, I don't remember much what happened after that. I think it was God's providence that I don't remember a whole lot of what happened immediately after that. But I went to stay with my dad's parents that night, and my mom went to the Fergus Falls Sanitarium. At the time, it was still in operation as a sanitarium. And the alcoholism was treated very differently back in the 60s than what we know about it today, as well as mental health issues. And I didn't realize that some of those mental health issues would also be passed on to myself and to my children. Anyway, so we, I went to stay with my grandparents on my father's side, and once in a while he'd come in and visit me and take me to see my mom at the sanitarium. And let's see, I stayed with my grandparents for 2 years, almost 2 years. It was just before my sixth birthday. I remember my grandmother packing everything that I owned into a suitcase and going out to my dad's car. And my grandmother and my dad got into a really, really awful fight. And, well, let me back up for just a moment. At my grandmother and grandfather's house, they were very devout Christians. Lutherans is the what they practiced. And we went to church every Sunday. They were very faithful. And when I was about 5 years old, my grandma, when we sat down to say prayers at night before I went to bed, she taught me the Lord's Prayer. And so that's kind of, that was instilled into me early, early at that point. And then that going back to that, it was a rainy April night, I remember very distinctly, and my grandmother and my dad got into a really, really horrible fight. And my dad took the suitcase and put it on the front floorboard and got me in the car, and we started driving away, and there were two strangers in the back seat. There was a woman with big black glasses and another and a man that I didn't recognize. I'd never seen them before. And unbeknownst to me, my grandmother wasn't going to be able to continue to take care of me. So this particular night was the night before I was going to be going to foster care. And this couple that was in the back seat would be my new mom and dad, and they would be taking me to the Twin Cities the following morning.
Wow. And you're six at this point.
Yes, just before my sixth birthday. Mm-hmm. So I'm very familiar with, you know, what's going on. And, well, at least I don't know the logistics of it, but I do know how I feel, and I do know my parents, and I'm very attached at this point, you know. That night was the last time I ever saw my grandparents. Wow. That's been kind of hard. And I should warn you. I think I warned you before the show. I do tend to cry. Anyway, so I went to the, we came to the cities, and second dad, and this is going to be hard for me to try to figure out how to explain this, but my second dad, the adoptive dad, was extremely physically abusive. He was also an alcoholic. My adoptive mom, on the other hand, was just above board and just awesome. I mean, she was the bulwark, I guess, that I really needed. She was my stability. She was my rock. And she took me in and just took care of me immensely, wonderfully. But there were two times that I know that that one time in particular, I was outside playing and I found her out in the field, and she was trying to hide the fact that he had just broken her arm again.
Oh, boy.
And so do we need to go to a break?
No, we're doing okay. Fine. Yeah.
she's from very hearty Swedish stock, and so you don't talk. You don't say anything negative. You don't share tears. You don't share feelings. You just don't share any of that. So she just told me to go ahead and continue to play or whatever I was doing. Anyway, we bought a new house. Within the first year and a half, and then six months. Well, shortly after that, after we got into the new house, the second dad began to physically abuse me, and I don't need to. It's it wasn't sexual abuse. It was just physical abuse. And so, anyway, the 6 months after we moved into the new house, again, I witnessed the fight, another fight in the kitchen again, screaming and hollering and stuff at each other. But, of course, my mom was just, I mean, she was very much in control and knew what was going, you know, what was happening. But their marriage ended that night. And so I had no clue what was going to happen to me now. Again, I was thinking, well, so now what? You know, I mean, at this point, I was 8. And we left and moved in with some friends of ours. And about 2 weeks later, my mom got a call at 6 o'clock in the morning and, they said that the house was on fire and, that it was totally engulfed and that we needed to get over there right away. So she loaded me up in the car and middle of February in Brooklyn Park and she, and we stood outside as we watched the last of the flames go ahead and take away all of the possessions and everything that I had brought with me, any of the mementos or anything from my original family along with it. So it was just my mom and me and whatever I had brought to stay at our friend's house, and same with her.
Okay, so there's a lot of drama for a 6 to 8 year old little girl who's getting bounced around, witnessing violence, and also being the victim of violence.
Yep.
And so what happens to your little voice? Does it just go quiet?
Abandonment, fear.
Yeah. Sure.
Awesome fear.
Can you talk to anybody about this?
Or you're just,
No.
Not at that point in time.
No, that's not even, you don't even have the language to process that, do you?
No. Mm-mm.
So you stay quiet, and those very challenging, difficult feelings just start getting buried.
Yep, they do.
Right? Mm-hmm. Huh. I think we're setting the stage, George, for some interesting things going forward. Your thoughts?
Wow. Yeah, just traumatic. Very traumatic, Bill, to listen to.
I know. It is. I expected more insight from you, but that's okay.
Well, I try not to let you down. I try to be consistent, you know. I think the normal things that you rely on weren't there at all.
Yeah. Yeah, the safety and security, when those feelings go away for a little boy or girl, that is going to be an absolute game changer, and that is going to cause problems down the road for sure. So I think we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to hear more of Peggy's story. You are listening to Real Recovery, and we're so glad you are, Bill and George. We have Ryan on the board, who is getting a small commission for speaking tonight. He did say a couple of words, so that's worth something to us. And I promise, 90 seconds, we'll be right back.
Never met a man, a stranger, who lives his life for a dollar sign, and the deal with him is dangerous. Well, he knocked me down, but I'm on my feet.
I remember when I lost my
Welcome back to Real Recovery, Bill and George. We're so glad you're with us tonight. We're hearing a great story from Peggy Isaacson. And Peggy, I have to say, from, 6 to 8 years old, you went through a lot. I had to take a deep breath, process that, and I know you have as well.
Yes, we both did.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Let's get to a slightly older Peggy, where you are maybe trying to do some self-medication of your own.
Yes, I am. And I would like to read just a portion of what actually happened at that point in time.
Awesome. Yeah, you write
and it'll
beautifully.
Just take
if it's your writing, I want to hear it.
All right. Thank you. This part of my story begins with seeds that were sown early in my life. Accepting Christ at the age of 9 had given me a preview glimpse into the life I dreamed of having, but difficult events in my early childhood had left me with an inherent fear of abandonment and the resulting compulsion to perfection and people-pleasing. In rebellion, I determined early that I would never need, trust, or be controlled by anyone else ever again. Sadly, that seed of rebellion that was then cultivated for many years, fertilized by deeply rooted anger and fear. My life became defined by my own opinion, and thus began my desperate journey of remaining morally upright while still meeting my own exhausting expectations of myself and others. Unable to fulfill those self-imposed expectations eventually led to a tumultuous, many-year love affair with the bottle. It began innocently enough. The occasional wine cooler at business functions and a mixed drink at dinner were temporarily able to quell the voices of frustration, anger, guilt, and the ever-present fear. Yet in every dimension of my life, I was still driven by the voices in my head, the ones that continually reminded me that my life was never enough. My real estate banking career didn't pay enough. My children didn't behave well enough. The house was never clean enough. I wasn't giving, working, Christian, organized, patient, or good-looking enough. Always pushing, striving, working, controlling, but it was never enough. And then there was my incredible husband. What had begun in high school as a love story that could have rivaled any steamy romance novel had become a marriage that wasn't enough either. What had gone wrong? How could I be in this place? A middle-aged Christian wife, grandmother, and businesswoman turned homemaker? Why wasn't life working for me? In an unending, suffocating cycle of guilt and shame, the trysts with my lover became more frequent and intense as the remorse and disgust with myself over the affair itself would increase. Still, I clung to my lover in a frantic attempt to pour serenity over my parched soul. Then, finally, it went too far. Finally, after a particularly unbridled rendezvous with my lover, his face changed. No longer the liquid companion that had once brought solace, he now had the contorted face of my true enemy, and I no longer had the strength to slam on the brakes. My carefully applied facade of control and confidence gave way, and I was imprisoned in an inky black pit of depression and despair. And as I heard the merciless laughter of my lover behind me, I slid helplessly into the pit. Closing my eyes, I resigned. Evil had won that round, that time. It no longer mattered how good I was, or that I cried to the Lord and my family that I would quit. Neither did the lined, grief-stricken face of my husband or angry ultimatums. Even the self-loathing and guilt couldn't seem to stem the continued affair after the heart-rending hurt and disappointment in my beloved children's eyes. All that I cherished and was precious to me seemed lost in a thick gray fog. It was as though everything and everyone that once mattered didn't anymore. And no feel-good self-help books, Bible studies, or classes could help me measure up, clear my head, or numb the pain. I was defeated. I lay at the bottom of that tarry black pit that was aptly named Hopeless. Until remembering my prayer as a young girl, I was reminded that I wasn't alone. In one last grasping plea, I truly exposed my wounded soul to the one I had trusted to save me when I was young, but hadn't trusted enough with the rest of my life. And I let go and received his grace. Exhausted and beaten, with hands scraped bloody from the jagged blackness of my pit, I opened my bruised and beaten soul. Gently he brought me across the well-worn threshold of fear and whispered, "I love you. You can never do anything to make me love you more. And you can never do anything to make me love you less. My love doesn't depend on you. It's who I am." For the first time ever, I didn't have to measure up. I was safe. I wouldn't be abandoned. I was loved and treasured. I was cherished, just for who I was, sordid, ugly, imperfections included. So it was that the power and love of God, of grace, changed me. I will never be the same woman again.
Wow. Nicely done.
Thank you. Very true.
Yeah.
That is not me. That's not me anymore.
Yeah, well, I want to pick into that just a little bit because your story, that is, can you tell us just a little bit more about that?
About when I was young?
No, about that.
Oh, about what I just read?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. unlike most people, I didn't start drinking. Well, when I was younger, alcohol was always around, and as I had mentioned, my mother was an alcoholic. My stepdad was an alcoholic. I had my mother, my biological mother, had had to pick me up one time when I was 9, just before I had to choose which mom I wanted in a court of law, and that's another story too. But anyway, she had to pick me up, and we went to see her mother, and her mother was also an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got, it's not just the alcohol, but it's also the co-occurring mental issues that come into play here. And the mental issues for me, I did not realize it. Well, who was even thinking about PTSD or anything like that back in the 70s or 80s, or, you know, they just expected kids back then just to, you know, buck up, you know,
be
it's
resilient.
Past. Yeah.
Your
it's,
kids.
Yeah. It's, you know, like they say now that, you know, divorce, the kids will be fine. You know, no, they're not. I'm sorry. I just don't agree with that because they're not fine. You're tearing apart a family and you're tearing apart kids' lives. And nothing will be ever be the same again for them either. And the parents don't realize that what they are doing to their kids. And especially when, as we've been coming out of COVID, the amount of stress and the amount of abuse and amount of alcoholism that has come on the tail end of, especially on the tail end here of the stress and abuse issues, is just phenomenal. For myself, although there was a lot of alcohol, and this was really, really surprising to me, it was not just a PTSD issue from when I was little, but it was also the issue was pride. And I vowed up and down that there was no way that I was ever going to drink. I was never going to become an alcoholic. I was never going to let anyone mistreat me. I was never going to be abandoned again. I didn't let anyone in either. And so I didn't actually start drinking until it had come to a head where I had 4 kids at home. When I was 30, I had 4 children. I was working full time. And we were moving cross country. We moved cross country twice in 1 year with 4 kids and 2 dogs. One of the dogs had puppies on the way, and working full time in both places. I was a basket case, and it got to the point where it just seemed so much easier to do the, you know, after a long day at work, I'm just going ahead and having a drink, and then having half a bottle, and then having a whole bottle, and then keeping the bottle at home, and then hiding the bottle, and then not remembering a lot of things that I had just done the night before. And we spent, hubby and I say we because he, bless him, went through all of this with me as well. And we just celebrated our 35th anniversary. But I started drinking when I was 30. I mean, I did have social drinks prior to that. I don't consider that drinking, I really seriously knew what I was doing and purposely got into it. I purposely stepped into that's what I wanted. And by when I got into it and I couldn't stop it, it didn't matter because that was mine. And it was almost a part of my own identity because it was the only thing that gave me the strength to try to get through the next, 24 hours or however many hours I needed to get through. Because as I mentioned in my story, I had allowed God to save me when I was young, but I had not allowed him to actually be my Lord and take over my life. He should have been the one that was working with me to work on the issues from my past and the mental health issues and all of the other things that I never grieved over my past. I had just been told that it was in the past. Just forget it. It's done with. Over and done with. Leave it alone. And, you don't need to talk about it. And so I didn't. And Ron Hutchcraft, I think, who just recently, a couple of years ago now, I think, but was on with, I can't remember if it was Susie or Carmen, had just mentioned that in his new book, he talks about grief. And he talks about the fact that grief, whether it's the loss of a loved one, like he lost his wife very suddenly, and it was very, very tragic. And if it's a loss of a loved one or just any kind of major grief issue is much like a beach ball. And the longer that you go through your life and try to push that beach ball under the water, and the deeper you go, the harder it is to keep that beach ball.
Yeah, that's a great illustration.
From popping up.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to take a little break. You're listening to Road Recovery with Bill and George. We've got a great story from Peggy. We're going to take a 90-second break and be right back. That music means we're getting close to the end. Incredible story from Peggy Isaacson tonight. Excited to hear, George, what the Lord's doing in her life, in her recovery, which is solid.
Really been through a tremendous amount of pain and suffering. And I can't wait to hear how she's sharing that with other people, Bill.
Yeah, yeah. Peggy, so let's talk about what God has been doing in your life and how your recovery is today, what some of your disciplines are, your daily activities you do, and then how you're sharing your joy with others.
Wow. Let me revert very quickly back. 2014, I haven't been sober for a real long time. It's only been 7 years.
So nice amount of time.
Well, it's still not, I will get to George's 36 or something at some point, but unless the Lord, comes back and
we'll have you back on the show.
Gets us out of here.
George, when George and I'll have
you're
you back.
You're already on there on the quality of sobriety that George is.
It's just actually been in the last year that I've been able to really begin to process. It's only been the last year that I even have been made aware of the co-occurring incidences of mental health issues, and grief, and how it comes into play with addiction. And that was thanks to I am currently in the middle of beginning a women's recovery center. It's called Recovery Community Resources and recoverycr.org, just FYI. But we are just now being able to get some funding for it. For a women's, again, it's a co-occurring treatment center for women in the Detroit Lakes area. But Minnesota only has five total intense treatment centers in all the state of Minnesota and none in the northwestern Minnesota for women. Now, they're residential treatment. So the residential would be 180 days, 90 days, 60 days, and then 30 days, and then into outpatient and the follow-up support groups that come with that. That's our goal.
Nice.
And I know we're not going to talk about that a whole lot, but that has opened my eyes in the last year as to my need for... It was actually Dr. Troy and Dr. Susie, if anybody knows Susie Larson, is who I'm talking about, that they come on often. And I had seen Dr. Troy previously for many physical ailments, and physical ailments are many times a manifestation of mental issues that are going on that have not been treated, and not treated over a long period of time. It takes its toll. It's like being having your foot on the floor of the gas pedal on your car and having the brake on at the same time. And so it's, you know, fight, flight, or freeze. And when you are in that from the time that you're 4 years old and watch your parents take a gun and knife to each other, then you it just continues to get buried more and more. And until at one point it just bursts. Well, the alcohol kept it down for me for, you know, what, 20 years? Not quite 20 years. But but in the meantime, I just continued to add more grief issues. I mean, there were things that I did not deal with. There were things that being a parent alone without alcohol is difficult enough. But and, you know, yeah, that was my excuse as to why I needed to drink, but that wasn't true. It was a matter of I didn't want to try to deal with anything else. I just couldn't process it anymore, like you were saying, Bill. I didn't know where to go or what to do to try to actually process what had happened to me when I was young. And so I just drank and I drank and then just continued to get more problems. I had DUIs. I was in jail. I was in outpatient. I never did actually do a full stint in an inpatient. Well, it used to be called inpatient. Now it's called residential. But I think I would have been able to benefit immensely if I'd been able to go to an inpatient residential that was actually more local to us. And that's why we are trying to get one instituted here in mm-hmm. Detroit Lakes. But the alcohol caused a ton of issues that then you have to, once you quit drinking, okay, there's also, it's not just the mental thing either. It's also the physical thing, because now your body itself is also physically addicted. You know, it needs that to be able to process anything else. And now they've got drugs that can help you work your way off of that. But you've got to do these things slowly. I mean, it didn't all come to a head all at once. And it's not going to all go away all at once just because you up and decide you're not going to drink anymore. But when the Lord came in, as I mentioned, when I had just, I could not deal with anymore, it was a step-by-step process coming out of that pit. It was a huge matter of depression. And I had dealt with depression most of my life on and off, and as did my mom, as does my daughter. And that is hereditary. And when you're already depressed and not grieving over things that had happened to you previously, you add alcohol on top of that, which is also a depressant. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's just, you know, I'm sorry, the enemy knows exactly what he's doing. He's no dumb cookie, you know? It's like, he knew exactly where to get me and what to do. And I like I said, I'd promised myself that would never, ever happen to me. And that's exactly what did happen to me. You know, take heed lest you fall, you know, where it talks about in scripture. Yeah, I was pretty puffed up about the fact that I wasn't an alcoholic until I started drinking and couldn't remember things. And then all of a sudden, I didn't say that anymore because I knew myself that I had problems, but I wasn't willing to admit to them. And so you got pride added on top of stupidity and grief. And for me, it was anger and resentment. And the real underlying issue with that is fear. I was afraid. I was so afraid of being abandoned again. I was certain I would, but the Lord is working tremendously. And a lot of that has to do with my working with Dr. Troy on a holistic approach, doing physical, first of all, try to get some of the physical issues under control, but in conjunction with one of his therapists that we actually talk, you know, every week or every other week, and I can share with her, and she goes ahead and applies it and is able to actually do therapy with me, talk to me about, you know, where I need to go with this, and how the Lord actually looks at this, and, you know, and just continually reminds me that I'm not worthless, that I am very valuable, that I am very loved. Because, yes, the Lord did tell me that, and I did feel that, just that blanket, that, you know, his hand pulling me out of that pit, I will never forget it. But then you still have to walk it out. You still have to let him continue to, you know, walk with you daily. And that's why he does, you know, that's why we've got his word, mm-hmm. to be in daily and to have that word in your mind. And it's a change of mind. So yeah. It's body, mind, and soul.
George, you say that all the time.
How are you walking out your sobriety? How are you maintaining and increasing your sobriety?
Oh, that's a tough question. I'm not sure how to answer that, except for I've just been really pursuing scripture, and my prayer life has just increased exponentially. It got to a point where probably it took a while, but it was probably about 3 years ago that I didn't think about drinking anymore. And I've had some really severe issues come up. And when they do, really grief ones, then it was like, oh, I remember why I drank. And then it's like, where did that thought come from? You know, sometimes I think about it as like a bird that's flying over my head and does a number on my hair. And it's like, okay, where did that come from? You know, because thoughts just pop into my brain. But as far as, I haven't been going to AA, and I do agree wholeheartedly with AA. Celebrate Recovery is a huge thing for me, and my church fellowship, and the 12 steps, the Christian 12 steps is awesome.
Yeah, that sounds like a pretty good answer, if you want my opinion. Nicely done.
How often do you go to your Celebrate Recovery?
Only every other couple of weeks. I'm not real faithful with being able to go every week like I need to because, well, another excuse, but health issues have really taken me down some bad paths.
Yeah. Well, Peggy, it's been really interesting to hear your story. You've taken us on quite a journey. I so appreciate you being willing to share it.
Thank you, Bill. Yeah. Thank you, George. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, that wraps up another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. So glad you joined us tonight. Thank you so much. Have a great night, everyone. We'll see you next time.
I never meant to do those things to you. And so I have to say before I go.
Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.